Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about the array of bills passed by the legislature, either signed by Governor Newsom or pending his signature or veto. And then later on in the hour, we'll take a look at controversy in a Ventura County school district where young kids are going to have a gender diversity curricula. Parents are concerned about it, want the ability to have their kids opt out, which the district says is not planned for. But first, as part of a week-long series here on 89.3, we're joining with hundreds of media outlets globally to provide Covering Climate Now. It's a week-long series, and we begin by focusing on what the priorities should be for spending when it comes to climate change. A New Yorker piece last week, written by novelist Jonathan Franzen, made the argument that human nature essentially being what it is, there was no way that we were going to be able to meet the kinds of limits necessary on CO2 emissions to avert serious climate change, and that we had to prepare for a world that would be dramatically different as a result. That piece was widely criticized, condemned by scientists, but we open up the question, what should be the priority for spending? And we begin with USC, a professor of public policy and economics. He directs SC's Center for Sustainability Solutions, Antonio Bento. Professor Bento, thank you so much for being with us. First of all, your response to Franzen's piece, what did you think?
Well, I think that we have seen essentially two camps when it comes to climate change. Those that perhaps are overly alarmists, and then those that are overly optimists. And what we are trying to do at the USC Center for Sustainability Solutions is actually to foster a dialogue to actually put forward what I would call reasonable solutions. And as we talk about this issue of spending for climate change, we probably should first think about what is the root of the problem of climate change. And I think in a nutshell, partly because I'm an economist, the way I see the problem of climate change comes from the fact that most of the decisions that we do not necessarily account for the emissions that we generate. We are here in Southern California, and I think the most visual example is to consider the issue of driving. So when you and I make our driving decisions in the morning, we essentially pay for the private cost of driving, but we are certainly not paying for the emissions we are generating. And so when we think about funding climate change, the first issue is actually to think about where the funding is coming from. And for the most part, economists that agree that the most sensitive way to move forward is to actually put a price on carbon, whether it's in the form of a carbon tax or a cap and trade program. So I think before we talk about spending, we need to talk about funding. And there's clearly at least an agreement within the economics profession, and in fact, a case put forward by a conservative way of moving forward with climate change that calls for carbon pricing. Now, when it comes to spending, I think we really need to talk about the key sources of greenhouse gas emissions and ask ourselves the following question. Does it make sense for the government to intervene in those areas? So, for example, if we want to zero in emissions from transportation, power, or buildings, what should be the role for government? And I think the conversation should be about the trade-offs that we face when we start putting those spending in place.
Let me step back to a sort of an even more general level. One of the things that I hear from people who are skeptical of big interventions on CO2 emissions is that even if the United States was in and of itself able to significantly cut back on carbon, it would be dwarfed by what happens in the rest of the world. So the argument is you would have a huge economic hit to the standard of living of Americans for what would be minimal or no gain in a global context. How do you respond to that?
So, Larry, with all the respect, I have to say that I fundamentally disagree with that argument. And I think for us to understand the reason why I disagree, we need to ask ourselves, under what conditions would it be in the best interest of a country to act on climate in isolation? And I think this goes back to the way we frame the issue of climate change. The minute we start realizing that climate change is actually affecting our day-to-day lives, whether it's in the form of local air pollution, wildfires, or droughts, then there is actually a case for countries to act in isolation. Let's actually suppose, for example, the United States or China decide to be the first movers. Well, these are sufficiently large countries that if other countries that did not act on climate all of a sudden want to sell their goods in our country, what our country could do is actually introduce a carbon border adjustment that essentially levels the countries out. So this idea that we are going to put our economy at risk, it's simply not correct. And in fact, by acting earlier, we could be the innovators.
We're talking with USC professor Antonio Bentu. He directs the Center for Sustainability Solutions at SC. Also with us, director of the Competitive Enterprise Institute's Center for Energy and Environment, Myron Ebel, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a libertarian-minded think tank based in D.C. Mr. Ebel, thank you for being with us. First, where do you think the priority should be economically in addressing climate change?
First, Larry, thanks for having me, for having a skeptical voice on your show. I'm sure I won't be too popular with many of your listeners. I think Mr. Franzen's article saying we're not going to reduce emissions, so we're going to have to get used to and adapt to climate change, I think he gets the first part right. I think the second part, he listens too much to the alarmists. If you look at the rate of warming, the actual rate of warming compared to what has been predicted, it's much lower, it's much more modest, and the impacts have been mild and so far largely beneficial. And so we don't see trends in severe weather events or droughts. We don't see trends in global food production. In fact, keeps going up, for example, every decade. I do think that we need to understand that 80% of the world's energy comes from coal, oil, and natural gas, and that's the same as 30 years ago, except that in the 30 years since, the amount of energy that the world is using has gone up dramatically. So these government efforts to reduce emissions are extremely expensive, and they're, in my view, very wrong-headed.
Obviously, the projections are based on computer modeling. There can be differences in those models. But the fundamental premise here, the science behind it, is so strong that CO2 emissions lead to global warming, which then lead to some sort of consequence that is not consequence-free. And you can debate how extensive that is or isn't. But given that at least some of the modeling shows extreme damage done economically and environmentally to the world, would it not make sense to invest in attempting to deal with, if not a worst case, one of the more serious case projections?
Larry, I have two answers here. The first is these projections of damages are not actually large when you look at them. The Fourth National Climate Assessment used the most extreme scenario and came up with $500 billion a year in 2100. Well, the size of our economy in 2100, assuming we don't wreck it with statist policies, is going to be so large that $500 billion is a very small amount. Moreover, the climate models that predict rapid warming have actually been falsified by the data, and yet we continue to talk about them as if they haven't been falsified. Now, the other thing is, What makes a society able to cope with challenges? In my view, what is sustainable is widespread private property ownership and free markets. Government intervention has a long history of not being sustainable, and in fact of making most problems worse.
But there is an advantage governments have over private industry, and that is that they can plan. And when you've got competitive industries, planning is not necessarily, you know, foremost there. So isn't there a role here for government? Let's take an example of sea level rise, for government to figure out, well, what are the mitigations we're going to have to do as sea level increases for properties along the coast, infrastructure and the like. Professor, you want to comment on that?
Yes, I do. So first of all, this is a very interesting segment because I don't think you could have picked two more distinct speakers. But you know, as an economist by training, I too believe in free markets. For the most part, free markets work, but they often don't work when the actions that you or I do or polluting facilities do cause damage on others. And the fundamental premise is that under those circumstances, the prices that we see emerging in the economy are fundamentally wrong because they do not account for the damage that is being created. In economics, we call that externalities. You don't need to be a Democrat or a Republican to understand the concept. And therefore, unless you put a price on carbon, you're just simply not going to solve the problem. So that's one aspect. So I, too, believe in the idea of private property rights. I do not believe that we are moving towards a supersized government, but I do believe that there is a role for government intervention every time there are market failures in society.
Well, and when you're talking about the price of carbon, isn't that, in a sense, similar to the sea level rise? Because you're talking about what are potentially greater costs than even now. Yes, I mean, you can point to certain things, but it's difficult to say, well, fire season X was distinctly caused by fossil fuel production over the last 20 years.
That's absolutely right. And so I must say that I'm very surprised with these arguments that continue to come forward from libertarians, because actually, if we look at the spectrum of politicians, and if we go back to a distinguished statement, James Baker, Secretary of State in a Republican administration, he has actually convened a group of economists to develop a conservative approach to climate change. But of course, that starts with two premises. First, you need to believe that it exists. And then once you believe that it exists, you need to find the most cost-effective way to address it, and that is by putting a price on carbon. Now, you asked us about expenses. I think before we talk about investments, we need to ask ourselves what we would do if indeed we were able to collect revenues by putting a price on carbon. Well, a very simple way to use the revenues is actually to return them to all households in a lump sum fashion. But of course, I think another aspect that is quite interesting is that because of the problems that you were referring to, including sea level rise, including the wildfires that we are talking, that we are witnessing here in California, including the deterioration of air quality in some of our most vulnerable communities, there may be a case for actually using many of these revenues to invest in adaptation programs that actually level out those most vulnerable communities.
What about investing in efforts to try and mitigate increases in temperature? There are technologies that have been at least theoretically proposed that would do that. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's more of a question of timing. In principle, if the technologies are going to be competitive and if the price on carbon is right, eventually they will emerge in the marketplace. So the question then becomes, how fast do we want to act on climate? If indeed there are reasons to subsidize technologies because through learning by doing, their costs drop relatively faster, then indeed there is a case for doing that.
We're talking with USC Professor Antonio Bentu. He's Professor of Public Policy and Economics and directs SC's Center for Sustainability Solutions. Also with us is Myron Ebell, who directs the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the Libertarian Think Tank's their Center for Energy and Environment. We're going to take a brief break. We'll continue our conversation with our guests and hear what Myron Ebell thinks about the potential of investing in mitigation technologies related to climate change. You can share your questions or comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back momentarily. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're joining with media outlets around the world in Covering Climate Now, a week-long special focus highlighting climate change. KPCC throughout our broadcast day, picking up a variety of different subjects related to climate change. Right now, we're talking about what priorities there should be for funding on climate change. We're talking with Myron Ebell of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in D.C., libertarian-minded think tank. He led President Trump's EPA transition team. And Antonio Bentu, USC professor of public policy and economics. He directs SC's Center for Sustainability Solutions. Myron Ebell, wanted to ask you about what you think of some of these theoretical approaches. If we're not successful in cutting CO2 emissions enough to avoid global warming, other ways that perhaps we could try and manipulate the climate. Do you think any of those are promising enough to pursue?
I'm very hesitant to promote geoengineering or other ways to prevent climate change. It presupposes a lot of human knowledge that we're really godlike and we can manipulate the climate. And first of all, it presupposes the answer to a very difficult question. What is the ideal temperature for the world? And is the ideal temperature, should we set it so that it suits the people in Los Angeles or in Siberia or in Latin America or Africa or Kansas? I don't know. I don't know what the ideal temperature is. I do know that most of the warming since the end of the little, all of the warming since the end of the Little Ice Age in the 19th century has largely been beneficial for the world, but of course, there are places where you could say, well, no, it actually hasn't been beneficial. But I think one measure of human well-being is global food production. Global food production continues to go up as a result of multiple factors. One of them is the greening of the earth caused by higher carbon dioxide levels. It's not the only one, but it's one of them. So that's something that I think most people would see as good, that global food production continues to go up. So, no, I don't want to play God, and I don't think we should want our governments to play God.
So if you are dealing with, in fact, more catastrophic storms, if you're dealing with larger and more acreage of wildfires overall, you're looking at sea level rise threatening certain populations where people would have to be relocated, areas of the U.S. coast just in this country alone that would have to be fortified against sea level rise. I mean, all of this, you'd have to admit, Mr. Ebell, huge economic impacts.
Well, so far we haven't seen any trend, and I think if you look at the UN IPCC reports, we haven't seen any trend in severe weather events. We've actually in this country have a declining trend in wildfires. And by the way, I'm from the Intermountain West, and I have direct experience of forest fires. They have nothing to do with climate. They have everything to do with colossal, unbelievable federal mismanagement of our forest resources. So that's sea level rise, yes. Sea levels have been rising on and off since the end of the last ice age, about 13 to 14,000 years ago. In the 20th century, they rose about 8 inches on average. In the 21st century, it looks like the rate could have gone up to as much as 12 inches per century. So we will have to deal with that. I agree. We dealt with it in the 19th century when they went up about 8 inches, in the 20th century about 8 inches, and the 21st century, if it's 12 inches, we'll probably have to deal with that. But
okay.
It's a minor, Holland dealt with sea level rise and drained the salt marshes using pre-modern technology And at the same time, they became one of the richest countries in the world. So,
Professor Bentu, first of all, the contention that storms, weather patterns have not been changed to this point by rising temperature.
Well, I really don't know where Mr. Bell gets his information from. We must clearly be reading other sources of information, because I think the scientific community unanimously agree that all these events that we are seeing are directly linked with climate change, with rises in temperature. I also want to correct this point related to increases in food production. Well, food production has not increased because of increases in temperature. Food production has increased because we've improved the technologies that we use in food production, for example, through genetically modified crops, by adding resistance to crops, by making actually land more productive.
I do think, though, that's part of Mr. Ebel's argument.
I understand.
The technology can mitigate it.
I understand, but part of the counterfactual would be, how much more have food production grown had we actually addressed the climate change problem? And the issue and the point here is that it would have grown much, much more. So the point is just simply incorrect. Actually, the other reality when it comes to impacts of climate change and an impact that that all our listeners probably are noticing here in LA is the rapid deterioration of our air quality. So the reason why Los Angeles has been in violation for the federal ozone standard now pretty much throughout the summer is not because our local regulators have not done everything that they could to reduce the precursors of ozone. It's because the formation of ozone interacts with temperature and with sunlight, and it's well documented in the literature that as warming takes place, so does the rise of ozone emissions. And I think that's basically a scientific fact.
Doesn't have to do with more vehicles on the road, because we do have a lot more cars.
Of course, we do have a lot more cars, but fuel economy, through fuel economy standards, the average efficiency of the cars have improved. I am not saying that the increases in ozone are exclusively a result of temperature. All I'm pointing is that temperature alone has a very important effect on ozone.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for being with us and sharing your diametrically opposite points of views. That's USC Professor Antonio Bentu. He's Professor of Public Policy and Economics and directs SC's Center for Sustainability Solutions. And my thanks to libertarian-minded think tank Competitive Enterprise Institute's Myron Ebel. He directs the Center for Energy and Environment there and led President Trump's EPA transition team. Coming right up, we'll talk about the progressive bills that have been passed and a number of them signed into law in California as it further establishes itself on the leading edge of progressivism here in the U.S. We'll be back momentarily.